So we're continuing in the study of Revelation. We are in Revelation 12, and let's go ahead and reread that chapter. And Sister Carrie, could you read verses 1 through 5? And then Brother David Vickery, 6 through 11. And then Brother Adi, 12 through 17, please.
Okay, Revelations 12, 1. And a great sign was seen in the heavens, a woman having been clothed with the sun, and the moon was underneath her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars. And having a babe in the womb, she cries, being in labor and having been distressed to bear. Another sign was seen in the heavens, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of the heaven, and he throws them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman being about to bear, so that when she bears, he might devour her child. And she bore a son, a male, who is going to shepherd all the nations with an iron staff. And her child was caught away to God and to his throne.
And the woman fled into the desert, where she had a place prepared by God, that there they may nourish her 1,260 days. And there was a war in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting with the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels, and were not strong, neither was their place found any longer in heaven. And that great dragon was cast out, that old serpent, which is called the enemy, even that adversary who is deceiving the whole habitable. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now is come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his anointed one. Because that accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast out, and they conquered him through the blood of the Lamb and through the word of their testimony, and they loved not their life to death.
Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury, because he knows that his time is short. Then when the dragon saw that he had been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle, so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the wilderness, where she would be taken care of for a time, times and a half a time, out of the serpent's reach. Then from the mouth of the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to wage war against the rest of her offspring, those who keep God's commands and hold fast to their testimony about Jesus.
All right, thank you. So, brethren, as you recall, last week we made a mention. We looked at the Revelation 12 verses overview was suggested time periods, and so we've looked at that. We're not going to, you know, review that, as it were, but just to say that this chapter is one of the unique features, is it covers the entire gospel age, and that it's introducing to us again, we had it in our seven churches, our seven seals, and our seven trumpets. But once again, from another perspective, it's introducing the problems of Satan's infiltration and counterfeit into Christianity. And we see the development of the nominal church state systems during the gospel age. And so this is what we're learning about in this chapter. And we look for counterfeiter, or we look for how Satan used misdirection in trying to hinder the completion of the bride of Christ. And we're seeing in this chapter once again, like we saw earlier in the Revelation, that in the early days, Satan tried to persecute it, particularly through misguided Jewish leadership, then through pagan Roman persecution, and then in this chapter, and in fact, starting with our verse 3, we start to see 3 and 4, we start to see the transition from the pagan Roman persecution to a nominal Holy Roman Empire being developed. And part of that is because we have this, the pregnant woman gives birth. And so that element that we talked about last week that really was not Christian, true Christian, but really the developing tear element, nominal Christian, is born. And so that also starts to show this change. So that's where we're picking up. But let me just ask, were there any comments or questions left over from last week? So we'll start. And our verse 3, and there appeared another wonder or sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon the heads. So this is our introduction to this a great red dragon. And so who would like to give us an overview of this verse 3? What do these symbols represent for us? Sister Roseanne.
Yeah. the great red dragon with the 7 horns and the 7 heads. The dragon represents, like you were saying, pagan Rome transitioning into the Holy Roman Empire. And the heads represent, I believe, 7 successive forms of government over the 7 forms of successive government. And the horns, I think, are the civil powers that like the power of the government that support the current form of government, the head. That makes sense?
Yes, it does. It makes good sense.
Okay.
Nope, that's very good. And so it's an excellent start, and who would like to add to that? Ruth.
Well, I was thinking that because it's in heaven, there appeared another wonder in heaven. It shows that the dragon claimed it was pagan Rome. It had a religious element to it, though, because the Pontifex Maximus title was given to the emperor. Isn't that correct?
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's in heaven, mm-hmm. Even though it's not the Christian heaven, but it's a religious world.
Okay, very good. Yeah, very good. So that's the thing, is that the emperor of Rome claimed to be both the religious head, as Ruth said, Pontifex Maximus, as well as the civil head. And more on that, but that's an excellent point on how that's demonstrated by being a sign in heaven, the nominal heavens, the nominal religious heavens, not the spiritual heavens, as we would understand. All right, very good. That's another aspect of it. Further comments on this verse as we flush this out? Brother Chris.
Just that it reminds us of that verse one, we go all the way back to the white horse, and I was going to see what chapter that was actually in, but then chapter two is changing colors, and then three, using that word red, just reminds us that now verse two is now turning red. It's now a red horse. Just to marry that together, over.
Very good. So that's Revelation 6, and that's the seals, as you're bringing out. Six seals are shown there. And yes, the horse is representing the doctrine, white, but then red, then black, and then a putrid color showing the decay or corruption of the doctrine. So we've moved along. We're in that red zone. All right, good. Further comments fleshing this out, verse 3. So some of the observations, Sister Carrie, is that a hand? Go ahead.
I was wondering if the heads had to do with the regions that were dominated by Rome. So almost what we would look at as countries today, there's about that many when I looked on the map. And then horns, I liked what Sister Ruth was saying about the power. I think it's sort of like the military might association of the, maybe over the regions, different regions of that Rome controlled. That's all.
Okay. All right. Very good. So let's pull us together a little bit. What we're going to see in the remainder of the Revelation is that a dragon or a beast that has seven heads and 10 horns, whether it's the dragon or the beast, it's identifying in general the Roman Empire. It's primarily a European picture, but it also includes the, over time, it includes where the European influence spread out to. So it can be broader as time goes on, including like their colonies, including the United States and Canada, for example. But it's an identifier of where it first began. And so, like an animal, whether a dragon or a beast, both bad, but whether a dragon or a beast, we understand that a head is where the brain is on an animal. And the brain is what gives control to the rest of the animal. So we feel that the best explanation of the seven heads is that the head is the government that's controlling that animal, dragon or beast. The head represents the controlling form of government at that period of time. And having seven heads, you wouldn't have seven controlling governments at the same time. So we've learned in the Revelation, one of the symbols is that seven is used to show seven consecutive periods. So we have the seven churches, seven successive stages of the development of the Christian church during the Gospel Age. Seven seals, likewise, seven successive periods during the Gospel Age. Seven trumpets, again, seven successive periods of time in the Gospel Age. The seven last plagues are poured out one at a time, showing a succession, even though we think that happens rather quickly, time-wise, yet they're not all seven dumped at once. So we think the seven successive heads are showing seven successive governments over the Roman Empire. One head at a time. But there are 10 horns, and we've learned that 10 represents completeness. And so the horns themselves, they aren't the brain, but a horn is what an animal will use to attack or defend itself. And the horns of an animal are always on the heads. Everything from a bull to, you know, you take your pick. You think of an animal that has horns, they're on the head. Because the head is the government. It's where the brain is. And it can turn and direct the animal. And it uses the, it gives direction to the horns under its authority or control to attack or defend itself. So the friends have, over the years, have likened the 10 horns as 10 powers. And those powers, tend to showing a completeness. Those powers can represent the various divisions of kingdoms, fiefdoms, or countries that are part of the overarching empire. And so historically, this was true. You would have in the Roman Empire, you had, even under pagan Rome, you had various countries that they dominated and used their military might to their advantage to conquer other enemies. And it was certainly true during the Holy Roman Empire, where you would have an emperor over the empire that consisted of various countries that were subject to him. So at 10 shows completeness, but sometimes there were 10, literally, and sometimes there's fewer. But that's not the point. It's not trying to keep track of the changing number. It's trying to demonstrate that it's just a more a complete aspect of this power. Sister Debbie.
An interesting thought that I had when you were talking about 7 and 10 is that it could also demonstrate that this rulership was perfect, not in God's eyes, but perfect. They had perfect control over the territory and complete military control. Just a thought. Over.
We appreciate that. We certainly can understand that, but historically it was pretty fractious. It wasn't very perfect, but I'm going to offer, because you suggest that, and you know, let each one be convinced in their own minds. I don't want to start a debate on that. But in my mind, I've thought over the years that Satan's counterfeit, he has 7 successive forms of government. The gospel church is developed during 7 periods of time. But instead of having all these various heads, we have one head, Christ Jesus. And instead of having to use earthly powers, the horns, the true church uses the truth. So Satan's counterfeit of what Christ is doing is very inferior compared to the successful method that Jesus uses to develop his bride, to develop his kingdom in embryo form during 7 successive periods of time. And instead of using carnal kings and weapons, he gives us the truth, and he's our one head. So anyway, that's kind of was my take on that. But for what it's worth, this is all for what it's worth. You know, when we think of the 10 horns, what other 10 that would fit nicely with that? Well, we've got the 10 toes of the metallic image smeared with miry clay. And we know that's the end of the empire. That's the end of the latter end of the Roman Empire, like at our time. But it does kind of fit with that. And in the book of Daniel, for horns showing power and the horns on a head, I don't expect y'all to have this memorized, because I don't, but keep your hand here in Revelation, but let's just take a look at Daniel, the 8th chapter for a moment. Daniel 8. Again, trying to use the Bible interpretation to help us with this. And let's see, Sister Connie, could you read in Daniel 8 for us? Well, it's it's all over the place in here, so I'm trying to pick out some good ones. Why don't you start in verse 1 and read through 1 through 8 to start.
In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And I saw in the vision, now it was so, that when I saw, I was in Shushan, the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in the vision, and I was by the river Ule. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher came up last. I saw the ram going westward and northward and southward, and no beast could stand before him, neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and magnified himself. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west over the face of the whole earth, and touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. And he came to the ram that had two horns, which I saw standing before the river, and ran upon him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with anger against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground and trampled upon him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. And the he-goat magnified himself exceedingly, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four notable horns toward the four winds of heaven.
All right. Now, Sister Connie, could you, same chapter 8, let's read the interpretation of this a little bit. Could you read verses 20 and through 22, please.
The ram which thou sawest that had the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough he-goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. And as for that which was broken in the place whereof four stood up, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not with his power.
All right, so Sister Connie, without going into, you know, a lot of detail here, but what do we learn about the Bible usage of animals' heads and horns?
Well, what did we learn? We know that the I won't do that very much justice. I'm sorry.
Well, let me walk you through it because, so the animals were told, what did the ram represent?
He was.
Verse 20.
Verse 20. The ram, he was the king of Media and Persia.
Okay. And particularly, on that ram, what was likened to that king, those two kings? What part of the animal?
The two horns.
Yeah. So we learn that the horns represent kings or powers.
Okay.
How many heads do we have on a ram?
One.
That's right. How many horns are on this head?
Two.
So it again demonstrates that we only need one head to support multiple kings. So when that ram ran into, when that ram was there, who guided who? Did the head turn the horns or did the horns turn the head?
The head turns the horns.
That's right. That's it. Perfect. So when we have this goat come along, how many horns does he have?
He has just one.
So that goat represents what?
Greece.
And so the horn is who in Greece?
Alexander.
Is that perfect? That's it. So we're seeing that when these two animals fought, they used their horns, their powers, but the horns were on the heads, and the heads were the government that gave direction to that power. So it's pretty straightforward on how to interpret this. But nonetheless, let's ask for other comments here while we're in Daniel 8, if anyone had anything more to say on this here. Okay. Well, then?
Well, it's not particularly related to the heads and the horns, but the animals, Daniel saw these governments in his vision as animals, and compared to Nebuchadnezzar seeing the four universal empires as glorious, more glorious figures, the head of gold and so on. So when we look at governments, man-made governments, the Gentile powers, we can see from God's perspective that they're represented well by ferocious animals, the way, you know, they govern people over.
All right, very good. Brother David.
This brother Dan's same thought. I was just going to say a little bit more about it. God uses his own creation to explain these spiritual beings, whereas man uses his own creation. That's a comment. Thank you.
Okay, certainly true. Especially when we think of so much of the worldly empires are Satan's creation through men, always inferior to God's creation. Satan's always trying to imitate what God has done or is doing. Okay, so let's just take this back to our Revelation 12. Again, we've got our a great red dragon. So we've learned that the animal is a government. The head is a form of government, and there's seven successive forms of government. And the ten horns represent ten powers, more or less, at any given time, under the more or less control of that head or that current government over the animal. And a great red dragon is demonstrating, the friends have said it, it's the great Roman Empire. But being red, the friends think, I've thought over the years, I think that represents pagan Rome primarily, because in part we're seeing a transition. This is what we're learning about. But the time that when we first saw this woman, the sign of this woman in heaven, 33 AD, it was pagan Rome. And as we know, Pontius Pilate was the one that put our Lord to death, and Augustus Caesar called for the taxation of all the world. And so the Roman Empire, pagan Roman Empire, was in control. The crowns are upon the heads. Now, this is a symbolism that appears in the next chapter. But there's a slight change, but it's good for us to talk about it for a few moments. So in our chapter 12, verse 3, great red dragon, the pagan Roman Empire, seven heads, and it has a head at one head at a time, form of government, and ten horns, more or less showing a complete power of the empire and the various countries or kings, as it were, under the control of the empire or that head. But we've got seven crowns upon the heads. So one crown per head. But when we only have one head at a time, what we want to talk about is that this expression of the crown being on the head of this Roman Empire. So let's turn to the next chapter, 13, chapter 13, and Brother Adi, could you read for us verses 1? Let me just think here for a second. We definitely want 1. Now, let's just start with 1.
The dragon stood on the shore of the sea, and I saw a beast coming out of the sea. It had 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 crowns on its horns, and on each head a blasphemous name.
So, Brother Adi, opening comments?
This one has 10 crowns on its horns and not on the head. So that's a difference. And the horns are military power, or so the military or would have the kingly authority, or that's my guess.
Okay. Can you tell us who this beast is?
The Roman Empire.
It's Roman Empire, but it's a particular,
the Holy Roman Empire.
That's true. That's true. But these names of blasphemy, what does that kind of focus on?
Oh, the Catholic Church, the
palace. Okay. System. Exactly. Exactly. Very good. Very good. Brother Chris, please.
Oh, I forgot what my comment was going to be, but it's more in relationship to that verse 3. These, I just Googled Roman shields, and every depiction of them are red. So it's, even though we have symbolic language here telling us a whole different story, the Lord gives us an actual literal identifier that can be applied to the players. If I remember my true comment, I'll raise my hand again. Thanks.
Well, you're right, and that is a big point. That the red was identified with Rome and pagan Rome as well. And you know, similarly, like you know, to go along with your comment, Babylon, which was depicted as a lion in Daniel the 7th chapter, lions were on the Ishtar Gate. Babylon. It was one of their symbols. Is very interesting. So yeah, sometimes the Lord uses actually something quite literal as well as the symbolic. Good, very good. Sister Debbie.
Just a question. Could we say in Revelations that dragons are civil powers and beasts are religious powers?
Yes. Yep. I think that bears out. Thank you. Ruth.
Well, I've always struggled with this concept of what the crowns on the heads and on the horns is. So can I say that in 13, when the beast has the crowns on the horns, it shows the papacy used the power of the kings that they crowned and uncrowned, used their military and their civil power to do its bidding, whereas pagan Rome, the crown was on the head, so it dictated and had its own military and dictated the rules and regulations everyone had to follow. So the power, like the papacy, even today, they don't have their own standing army. But back then, they didn't have their own standing army. They used the civil power of everybody else that they controlled.
Yeah, I think it's perfect expression. Couldn't improve upon it. Right on. Thank you. Brother Chris.
Yeah, I remember my comment, as Brother Adi was reading, that 13:1, the heads, oftentimes, when we look at these successions are emperors. And like the best example I can think of is Charles V. And he's pleading, this is during the time of Luther, he's pleading with the kings under his empire, as it were, to join him in this great campaign to uplift the great Catholic Church, as it were. So they would be the horns of power that he want. They've got the crowns. They've got the authority and the power, but he's the head. And he's trying to consolidate all of this, and it's a real struggle for him because they have their own agendas. And of course, we know it's all divided between Catholicism and Protestantism, and we'll get into all of that. But Charlemagne was ahead. So each of these are like empires ruled by a governing force, but authority over Europe, as you brought out earlier parts of Europe, or an ever-changing landscape as time goes on. And just to touch on that, you brought out the church. We have Jesus as the head, and through the timeline, it's a vertical picture of time, with Jesus the head, the beginning of the church, down through time to the feet members. Well, the beast is a horizontal view. You've got the head, the beginning of a situation. It doesn't always apply to the pictures, but as time goes on, you eventually get to the tail, which is the end of a vertical beast. So just to bring that all out, over.
Okay. End of a horizontal beast. Right? Yeah. Okay. Good. No, good. Thank you, Brother Chris. Other comments? So what we're seeing is in comparing Revelation 12:3 with Revelation 13:1, we're seeing, I'm reiterating what was said. We have a great red dragon, 7 heads, 10 horns, that represents the Roman Empire under pagan Roman influence at the time of the early church. In 13:1, we have a beast. A beast is different. This beast shows is showing the papacy as a controlling element of the Holy Roman Empire at its time. It has 7 heads and 10 horns, the same identifier that the dragon had, showing that we're talking about the same area, as it were. But we've moved along in our succession of heads. We don't have that, the pagan Roman emperor like you did at the time of Pentecost. But down the stream of time, we've moved along to another one of the heads, and this head is church and state. Because the Pope is crowning the kings of the empire. And so it's a church and state development. We'll talk more on that. But now back to our crowns. When the civil authority is in control, like with the Holy Roman Empire, that he was the emperor, I said that wrong, not the pagan Roman Empire. Pagan Roman Empire had a civil authority as its chief head, the emperor, but he claimed to be a religious head as well. So the crown is shown on the head. When you have the beast, which is primarily a religious authority who claims to have civil power too, the Pope is primarily a religious authority, but he also claims to have civil authority, then the crown is depicted on the horns, not on the head. So that seems to be, in the Revelation, the distinction of where these crowns are placed. On the head, with a primarily civil authority in control. On the horns, primarily religious authority in control. Sister Day.
Just a quick note on a little bit of the history of a Roman Empire. It's kind of not the Roman Empire itself, but just that period of time of Constantine and before. I was watching a documentary last night. Actually, it was a lecture, a historical lecture on that period. And when Diocletian was emperor, he was the Augustus, and he was letting Christianity just go its way. He wasn't, you know, too worried about it. And then Galerius, who later on became Caesar. Okay, let me explain the Tetrarchy first. Diocletian got tired of trying to rule this entire empire by himself. So he split it into actually four parts. The West, the two parts were the West and the East. And over the East, there would be, and the West, there would be two Augustuses, and under them two Caesars, so that there would be like a tetrarchy, four rulers. But Diocletian would be the absolute head of everything. And then he had Maximilian as his Caesar at first. Then he got made Maximian his Augustus of I think the West, and he was the East, or the other way, I can't remember who was with who. And then they made their Caesars Galerius and Constantinus, who was not Constantine that we know, but Constantinus. And when Diocletian, you know, had set this up, Galerius wound up, Galerius was married to two Christians. His wife was Christian. His mother was Christian. So, not married to two, but, and he wasn't, and he didn't like it at all. He felt that, you know, they should have, you know, they shouldn't have this Christianity. So he talked Diocletian into starting the 10 years of trouble that the Christians had, the 10 years trial and or persecution. And it stopped after 10 years, and Diocletian died and then that. But then the Constantinus, who was Caesar, when Maximilian died, he became Augustus of that side, and his son was Constantine. So I just wanted to lay that foundation, because I just thought it was fascinating how all this stuff worked out. Just, I don't know if it means anything, but I just thought I'd, you know, throw that out there. Over.
Okay, thank you, Sister Debbie. And the only comment I'll make on that at the moment is your helpful definition of a tetrarch is useful for us as well. Not that I want us to turn there, but if you're making notes, or this might ring a bell with you, in Luke, the third chapter, in the first several verses, it tells us that in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate, being governor of Judea, Herod was tetrarch. So there's that definition that Debbie gave. And Herod was tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of Idumea, and of the region of Trachonitis, and Licinius was tetrarch of Abilene. Just showing again these divisions of these various leaders over parts of the Roman Empire, particularly in the Middle East, is being brought up. So what Sister Debbie was explaining, we do have an application for that even at the time of when John the Baptist would begin his ministry in Jesus. So just a point of reference. That's Luke 3rd chapter opening verses. So going back then to our focus on the Revelation 12:3, what we're seeing then is the pagan Roman Empire, Great Red Dragon. Its head at this time is a pagan emperor. And the ten horns showing it has the powers over the empire working under that head, a pagan emperor. And then we turn to verse 4, 12:4. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon and as it was born. So what we're reading in this verse 4, his tale again would be then this, the pagan Roman Empire. Now, you and I, we talk about the body of Christ. And we use the body, the parts of a body and its symbolism in several ways. But if we try to use it in one way to denote the passage of time in the gospel age. I'm going back to the point. The Christ body, the body parts, how we use them to denote the passage of time during the gospel age, how might we use body parts to denote the passage of time with the Christ? Sister Debbie?
Well, with the Christ, it would be, you know, the head is the beginning when Jesus walked and he was the head. And then you had, like, if you go down to the shoulders and so forth, and that would be the apostles, the hands, you know, would be those, you know, who ministered out the gospel. And all the way down to the feet members, which is the time of the end. So it's a time thing, you know, going from top to bottom. Just like the golden image in Daniel was top to bottom, time-wise. And so the tail of the dragon is probably the tail end of the civil government of the Roman Empire. Over.
Okay, perfect. Great. We're going to think that's right on. Thank you. So who was the end of the pagan empire of Rome and actually transitioned to nominal Christianity? Sister Roseanne.
Constantine.
Okay, so he's the tail, or he's the end of this pagan Roman Empire, because he changed to Christianity, and then he became the emperor, as it were, and he draws a third part of the stars of heaven. So just not thinking of the third part so much, but what would the stars represent, the stars of heaven? Sister Roseanne.
We usually say stars represent teachers. So he drew a third of the religious, or what was early Christians with him. Oh, I could be wrong.
Okay. So a star is a light, a provider of light. Usually, if it's the true, it's provider of true light. But sometimes it's a false light, which we've learned. But nonetheless, the stars represent those who are supposed to be the light givers. And of course, we're talking about the early church. And we find that we have this point in time where it's not the 12 stars, which we already talked about. No, it's not them. This is later on. This is time has passed. This is at the point when we believe Constantine, the emperor who left paganism to become nominally Christian, that becomes our time frame. And so that gets us down to our period of the 313 AD. But his power to draw part of these light bearers to cast into the earth. Now, so we're going to stop here for a moment, and we'd like to read the email notes that I sent out for this historical background timing. There's a lot written on this by a lot of different authors, and some are better than others, indeed. And so I try to condense this from a talk we gave on Arius and Constantine as an overview, if you will. And we'll open it up for further additions if someone would like to add them. But let's start with this. Sister Cheryl, do you have that open before you?
Yes, I do.
Could you read the number one for us, please?
About Constantine. He was a military man first and foremost. He became an emperor in the western part of the empire when his father died in 306 AD. He was considered a Caesar, a lesser title than Augustus. In 312, he fought three decisive battles against the usurper Maxentius, the last one being the Battle of Milvian Bridge under the walls of Rome. The Senate now declared him to be both Augustus and Pontifex Maximus. It was during this campaign that it is suggested that he saw a flaming cross underneath the sun with the words, "By this sign, thou shalt conquer." He then had his soldiers put the sign on the cross on their shields. In 313, he, with Licinius, signed the Edict of Milan, granting religious freedom throughout the empire and decriminalized Christianity. In 323, he defeated Licinius. In 325, May 20th, he convened the Council of Nice or Nicaea in Western Turkey. He had succeeded in solidifying his power over the empire in a number of ways, but now the great controversy regarding the nature and relationship between God and Jesus was threatening to divide the empire along religious lines. He called the leading bishops and other leaders to Nice. He actually presided over and contributed to the debate, although he did not really understand the issues at stake. He was not baptized until he fell sick and died the same year, 337. In his later years, he actually accepted the Arian view and banished a number of the Orthodox bishops.
All right, so we're going to keep reading, and then we'll come back, and anyone can add to it as they like. And so, Sister Alice, do you have this reading available to you?
Yes, I do.
Could you read number 2 for us, please?
Okay. About Arius. He was a presbyter, having declined a loftier title and position in the church of at Alexandria, Egypt. He was said to have used logic and scriptures in his presentations and debates. His simple position was that God the Father always existed, that the Logos, the only begotten Son, was created out of some substance that had not existed before, being wholly separate from the Father, and that there had been a time when he had not existed. He suffered being excommunicated, banished, and then was reinstated back into imperial favor, being asked to come to Constantinople. He suddenly died, reportedly poisoned by jealous Orthodox leaders.
Okay, very good. So, again, we're going to wait for more contributions. Let's continue reading. Ruth, do you have this available? Could you read, why don't you read that number 3 for us?
About the Council of Nicaea, 325 AD. As already related, it was convened by the Emperor Constantine to try to unify the Christian churches by resolving the great controversy, the nature of God and Jesus. There were 318 bishops present. They were divided into 3 camps of thinking. 1, Arius' view that Jesus the Son was created and therefore inferior in nature and substance from the eternal God the Father. There was a time when Jesus did not exist. This was a minority view. 2, Athanasius, a deacon also from Alexandria, his view was that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit were one, but at the same time distinct from each other. This, too, was a minority view. 3, the majority view was somewhere between these 2. They hoped for language that could be found to incorporate aspects of the 2 opposing views. This did not happen. As emperor, Constantine was in the unusual position of presiding over and, in the end, deciding on the outcome of this first church council. He proposed the crucial formula of the relationship of Christ to God in the creed issued by the council. Overawed by the emperor, the bishops, with 2 exceptions only, signed the creed, many of them much against their inclinations. The Encyclopedia Britannica, 1971 edition. The council rejected Arius' view, and having nothing to replace it, they accepted Athanasius' view. Arius was condemned and banished. However, the great controversy did not end there and continued to rage on for about 60 years. A second church council convened by Emperor Theodosius in 381 finally determined that God the Father, Jesus the Son, and the Holy Spirit were co-eternal, co-equal, and were 3 persons, yet 1 God.
All right. Thank you. So, brethren, as I started, there's much written on this, and it's all very, very, very interesting. This is an overview. So we'll ask if there's anything anyone would like to add or add to this or ask questions about this so far. And then we'll connect it to our verses, but let's get this squared up a little bit. Sister Debbie.
Just a little note of interest, historically speaking, again, from the same lecture. It is known, well, he said it's known that Constantine wanted to be baptized in the Jordan River just like Jesus. But he fell ill and he couldn't make it. So that's why he was baptized on his deathbed. But he said that usually people were baptized on their deathbed because what better way to get into heaven in their mind than being baptized just before you die. So you can't sin between those two times. And, you know, he said that was an interesting note of history. That's all. Over.
Yeah, that became a nominal view indeed. And quite contrary to Jesus's example of being immersed 3.5 years before his death and as well as, so many others in the scripture. Okay. Other comments or questions on this? Brother Adi, then Brother Dan. Brother David. You're muted.
Just some historical background, because when the first council started, it wasn't a neutral, let's say, environment. The religious leaders, the bishops, came from persecution. They were persecuted. It was against the government. Christianity was against the government. And so they were maimed. They were tortured. And here, for the first time, they're being basically treated as royalty by bringing them to the council. I've heard that they gave them good meals, and so they're the influence of coming from a real bad situation where they were fearing for their lives. To now being put in a prominent situation had Constantine had a greater influence over them at that time. Over.
Okay, indeed. And so just to build on that just slightly, that's very good. Important thing to remember is that 10 years of prophesized persecution, severe persecution by pagan Rome, as prophesied at the second stage of the church, and we've read it and we studied it, Revelation 2 and verse 10. But nonetheless, the point well taken is that those Christian bishops and leaders who had previously been tormented, tortured, and outcasts were now invited to the splendor of the royal court and treated with respect. And to them, this must have been quite overwhelming. And actually, when you look back in church history, the nominal church feels this is a fabulous development. Good points to bring out. Thank you. Brother Dan.
Yeah, just first of all, appreciate the outline. It's a very, very good outline to give us the perspective. And I was, my memory is correct in reading the history here of Constantine, when he won this battle that you mentioned, the Milvian Bridge battle, if you will. And he saw this burning cross under the sun and was given a text or a message that he should go forth and conquer under this sign. And, you know, they even say that, and I think it's Eusebius that he had a dream as well that reinforced this. And then they put these signs of the cross or you know, there's various views of what the sign was. But this is spoken of as him becoming a Christian. But the historian Eusebius doesn't write about this until at least like 10 years later in his writings. So, you know, as we know about history, you can create history the way you want it. And so many Christians anyways have Constantine as a hero, becoming a Christian and accepting Christianity. But it's very doubtful that that was the case because he was a ruler and a politician who wanted to unite the empire. But he saw religion as a way of doing that. So this outline brings out, he used religion to unite his empire. And, so the story of his life is told as becoming a Christian. But that's quite questionable, but he did use, religion, in a, great way, if you will, as a political, ruler and as an emperor with great power, over.
All right. Thank you, Brother Dan. And indeed, it's reported that after claiming to be a Christian, he still murdered several family members. Not so good. Thank you. Brother David, please.
Well, thanks, Brother Rick. I was just thinking of that bit about Diocletian, that he declared himself a god, which made it impossible for Christians to bow down to him because there was only one god that they recognized. But Diocletian, at least this is my memory, made himself a god, forcing people to recognize him and give some kind of an oblation to him, elevating him and more or less having the same kind of mind as a citizen that he was their god. And then the other thing that I remembered, and I'm not sure of, but I remember it, is about the library in Alexandria being burned as a result possibly of this controversy between Arius and Athanasius, but I don't have any documentation on that, but I remember hearing that may have been something that transpired just in the same vein as Athanasius trying to poison, or one of Athanasius's followers trying to poison Arius. That's a comment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Brother David. I appreciate that. Ruth?
I was just looking at that verse 4, that the third part of the stars of heaven were cast to the earth. And I was thinking that I read the Council of Nicaea account in Harnack, which is a historian of that time period. And he was saying that the bishops made the decision based completely on earthly considerations and on political considerations, because they couldn't even follow the discussion. But that it was very well recognized that Arius had scripture and reason on his side, and that didn't sway them because they were making the decision based on earthly considerations. So I was looking at that they were cast to the earth. Over.
Well, that is a view. That is a view. We respect that view, but that would leave two-thirds not being cast down, which means the majority would have still been lights. I prefer the view that the third part of those bishops cast out of heaven were the Arians. Arius and his followers were cast out of the nominal heavens, being excommunicated and banished. So this is the nominal perspective. And it was the dragon who decided on that the Arius view was error. So it was Constantine's declaration siding with the majority of the Athanasian view. So this is, I take it the other angle, even though I'm familiar with what you're bringing out, Ruth. That's a way. Thank you. Brother Rolo, please.
Peace of God, dear brethren. I just wanted to clarify one small issue. Maybe I don't know too much history, but as far as I understand, from apostles' times, the sign of Christians was the fish. Now, my question is, why would Constantine, seeing that cross, lead him to, you know, lean to Christianity? Because I don't think Christianity had this sign, or maybe I don't know something. Thank you.
Okay. No, that's a good question. The fish was a prominent sign. I will make you fisher of men. But the anchor cross was also one that was in use. So you do have kind of a mix of symbolic imagery being used there. The key point is that the Constantine interpreted it as a sign of being Christian. So at his time, for sure, that was the thinking. But thank you, Brother James.
Yeah, my comment was kind of in piggybacking on what Brother Dan was talking about with Constantine being somewhat of a hero or held in respect to the nominal systems, and then tying it into our view of pagan Rome being this red dragon, and with the seven hills of Rome that kind of fit the picture of the seven heads of the dragon, which were prominent in pagan Rome. And then on the, eventually the Vatican City would be on the other side of the river as these seven hills, which also kind of sets up a counterfeit looking picture. And the animal that represented pagan Rome was the two wolves. You know, and if you ever seen the pictures of those, they look pretty beastly. They don't look like normal wolves. They're like pretty exaggerated looking wolves. And that Constantine would fit that picture as a wolf in sheep's clothing to the nominal Christians. So I just thought how interesting it was all that all those smaller pictures kind of fit and help complete the puzzle, if you will, of figuring out what that red dragon is. Over.
All right. Very good. Good points. We appreciate that. And, before I call on Sister Debbie, we'll take a moment to look at this, a side point that's relevant that Brother James brought out. It's in Revelation, the 17th chapter. It's our verse 9. Revelation 17:9. And here is the mind that hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen, one is. The other is not yet come. And when he cometh, it's for a continuous short space. So just stopping there, just to look at the brief connection. At the time of the Reformation, the Reformers used this verse to identify the papacy, part in control of the Holy Roman Emperor at that time, the 1500s. In order, they use this verse to help identify the city of Rome, the Seven Hills, as Brother James mentioned. And yet we know that what we're being taught here is that these heads are successive. Five are fallen, one is currently, and one's yet to come. So it's showing a succession. Five fallen mean five are past. So anyway, it's a nice, wonderful connection in the symbolism that we were talking about. So, okay, we'll go back to our points here. Thank you. Sister Debbie.
I just wanted to address Brother Orlando's question because, again, that was brought up in that lecture. They believe that Constantine, when he used the sign of the cross, it was the Chi Rho. Okay, it's also known as the as one of the earliest forms of Christogram. It's formed by superimposing the first two capital letters Chi and Rho, XP, of the Greek word Christos, which if I were to put it in like English letters, because it kind of looks like that, it would be XPIETOE. That's what it looks like, but it's in Greek letters. In such a way that the vertical stroke of the Rho intersects the center of the Chi. That's where you have that P with the X through it. If anybody's, you know, I don't know if you can see it on my little screen here. I'll kind of angle it a little bit. Maybe you're getting a glimpse there, a little glimpse of it as I kind of, there you go. Wait, there. It's the XP. And they said that this guy was, as an archaeologist, he said that they believe it's the Chi Rho because they found inscriptions of that symbol around Constantine's time, around his, you know, where he was and stuff like that. So they believe, you know, there's another symbol that it could have been, but they really believe it was the Chi Rho because Greek was a common language back then and Christos was the sign of the cross or Christ. So I'm just putting that out there. Over.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. That's all very reasonable. Very good. Thank you. But as we say, certainly by the time, you know, Constantine viewed it as a symbol of Christianity, because that's what he became, a Christian. So we'll leave it at that. Thank you. All right. So talking about this, well, let me read one little point I wanted to thought was very telling. This is from the Inside the Vatican magazine. They have different articles. This one happened to be on the Nicene Creed. Just one little point out of it that I thought was very telling. Quote, the first ecumenical council was called by Emperor Constantine in 325 AD to force the bishops to bring calm back to the empire. 318 bishops met at Nicaea to hammer out a solution to the crisis. The council fathers allowed Arius to make his case. One bishop, upon hearing Arius, finally had taken all that he could bear, approaching Arius as he droned on. Bishop Nicholas of Myra delivered a resounding slap as his response to heresy. Nicholas repented of his loss of control and asked to be expelled from the council. The other Orthodox bishops would not allow him to withdraw, but agreed to expunge his name from the list of attending fathers. So, dear Brother Arius, endured a slap, reminds us of Jesus, reminds us of the Apostle Paul. We read of them being abused in such a way when they were in their various council trials. Very interesting. But I, and for those of you who've also read other histories, you know, about this history from other writings, there's a common theme. And this paper is similar. When they quote Arius as saying, this is what they quote Arius as saying, quote, if the Father begat the Son, then he who was begotten had a beginning in existence. And from this, it follows that there was a time when the Son was not. End of quote. Well, that's right. But the majority couldn't receive it at the council. Okay. So then going back to this part of the its tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven and they cast them to the earth. Where have we previously studied about one-thirds in the Revelation? What context? Don't even need to know the verses, but what was the context of studying one-thirds? It was in the trumpets. When we studied in Revelation, the eighth and ninth chapter, we notice that regularly there was a third part. There was a third part. It's used three or four times. But when we studied that, what we determined was the three parts were showing three divisions of people, not numerically equal third parts, like three parts of 100 we would think of naturally as being 33 and a third. Three of them gets you to 100. But it's not numerical. It's showing that there are three parts. Some would be greater or smaller in number or influence, quite possibly. So in taking what we learned back there with the trumpets and coming and applying it here to this third part that of the stars of heaven, the nominal heavens, were cast to the earth, this was what we're saying. We think it represents the small number of Arian bishops who adopted or agreed with Arius's view that Jesus had been created, the Logos had been created. They were cast out from the nominal church heavens. And like we say, Arius was excommunicated. So that was our take on that. And so we'll just ask, were there any other comments on that along this line? Okay, we'll leave that there. Then in our fourth verse, Revelation 12:4, the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness where she hath a place prepared for her. Ah, brethren, I just glanced at my clock. I see we just don't have time to continue. Sorry, I should have looked before I started reading on that. We'll pick up with that next week, the latter part of that fourth verse, and we'll develop this. And so, sorry, we have to close here.